Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
That is a statement of fact that is objectively true, assuming you subscribe to the objective reality that I exist in.
And Justin Robert Mad Dog Young.
Hey, by the way, I'm starting a new nickname. It's the Mad Dog thing. So just go ahead and just refer to me as Mad Dog or Maddie or D Dog if you're just taking the D from Mad and putting.
Wait, can we call you just Justin Young MD for short?
Yeah, that's also another thing, or Matt or MD JRY.
Gentlemen, laugh it up, enjoy it while you can, because we're about to send Brian on a little adventure.
Uh oh. Where are we going?
Oh. Brian, are you spending enough time with your kids? Getting enough quality time?
Yeah, lately it's been pretty good. We went and saw a magic show last night. I took my daughter to see a magic show. My other daughter didn't want to see magic. I don't blame her. We went and saw Carbonero.
I hate what you do for a living, Daddy.
I know, right? I'd say it's good. It's good. Lots of time.
What else have you done?
We've wrestled. We've arm wrestled. So far, I'm undefeated.
How about the outdoorsy side of stuff?
We talk about going there sometimes.
Talk about going there.
Yeah.
Brian? Maybe. How about a nice little eco-friendly paddle boat little trip? Maybe a little fishing. Daddy showing the girls.
We do that all the time. We would rent a canoe and we'd paddle down the Comal River, and it's nice, crisp, clear, clean water. Feel like you commune with nature. Yeah, we've done that.
And fishing, showing how to fish.
Yeah, sure. A little bit of fishing is good.
Have you done this, Brian?
Do you want to pass on an angler's legacy?
Yeah, I'll say
generation?
I'll say this is I pass on. I don't have anything physical, but I could pass on. I say this is the expression I wore as my uncle tried to teach me how to fish, and I just kind of go slack jaw, like, and then I'm like, "That's yours now." And then she gets to wear it anytime she wants.
Well, Brian, you know, it's going to be important when the robot uprising happens, and they allow just maybe a few maintenance population humans left, you know, to sort of live off the land and survive, because they don't want to eradicate us entirely, but they do kill off 99.9% of the population. And, you know, a lot of the crumbling infrastructure sinks like that are going to make it very difficult. You can't just walk into Walmart and buy some cereal. You're going to have to teach your daughters how to, well, the daughter that lives, you know, you're going to have to teach her how to fish.
I mean, isn't that what the robots will think? Like, this is good stewardship of the environment. We should only have 5 humans for this 100 hectares or whatever.
Probably pretty much, and it's going to be decided by a random algorithm. So it'll just be you and one child. You have to choose.
I mean, does it get to be my child, or does it just pair me with a random other person's child?
You know what? It could be random, but you lucked out. It's one of your own.
Okay.
So every time you look in their face, you see the ones that were taken away by the robots, and we don't know what happened.
There's another robot that's measuring the capacity for human suffering, and so like this is like a side experiment where you have to choose.
You're asking me to choose which kid lives?
No, I'm not asking you to choose that. Brian, I'm telling you right now, you need to be working on their survival skills.
So, okay, so you're saying like I should prep all 3 of them so that no matter which one wins the lottery, they're better prepared.
Phrase it like that. Listen, only one of you will survive, and it better be the one that's capable of surviving.
I got to tell you, I feel like my middle kid wouldn't even need any training. I feel like she could probably start teaching me stuff immediately. Mm-hmm. She's you know what she's actually all the kids are in love with. Yeah, I've already started, Andrew. I'm looking out for you guys. And normally we don't do picks right at the beginning, but I got all my kids watching the Primitive Technology YouTube channel. Have you seen this?
Mm-mm.
Oh, my God. It's great. This dude, I think it's youtube.com/primitive technology. This guy's an enthusiast of Stone Age technology. He's got a day job. He's got a real gig. But then on weekends, he goes out to the middle of the woods. And the very first episode, you watch him make a thatched hut out of just grass that he's got laying around. And then you watch him build eventually this clay tiled roofed house complete with a heated floor that has like there's a fire that blasts through a channel underneath and warms the ground underneath him, on which he puts a bed. He puts an internal you watch him fire all the clay tiles. It's amazing.
Oh wow. Well, Brian, I was going to think something a little more simple. I think that you need to teach, you know, one of your daughters maybe how to fish.
That seems like a good idea. What's there to it? You take the hook, you put the worm on the hook, you put you put it in the water, you pull it out, and there's a fish. I've seen
Brian,
Popeye.
And I've got a video to show you how easy it is. I think Bryce has it queued up here, so just check this out. And I just want to imagine you, there's a daughter in back of you, you know, you choose, and you're going out on a little daddy-daughter fishing trip where you got your little pedal-powered boat, and you're out fishing.
Done and done. So you're out, you're grabbing your line.
Check pulling in a line.
Yeah.
Pulling in a line.
Pulling up, it feels like a big one. Probably a big
one.
That's a big ass gator, buddy.
Wait, back that up, because that looked an awful lot like that was an alligator he was pulling by the mouth. Okay.
God.
By the size of the snout. That is not a small gator.
Hey, forgive me for asking, but if I was going to guess what state in the United States this took place in, I would probably pick Florida.
Good guess. I have no idea. I didn't even bother checking.
Lake Foss Point State Park, St. Martinville, Louisiana.
Louisiana.
Yeah, I was going to say Louisiana. Yeah, that is, and by the way, how amazing is it that we have these moments captured in such high definition? But that almost looks like a Universal Studios prop, right?
Oh my God, and to realize that you're pulling it in, you're actively pulling him towards your boat, and he's not going to be happy. He ain't going to be happy.
And by the way, just the amazing, like, the change in posture from him pulling, I mean, again, like, not beyond just teaching his daughter how to fish, but like good form and pulling it up and staying balanced and everything. And then how much that all goes out of the window as soon as he sees the.
He does. He just crumbles.
River beast rising up to meet him. He just tosses it in, and he's just got like both hands up as if it were like a caricature of a 1950s housewife, like on the top of a chair.
Wait, it's
like,
almost as though it's almost as though he realizes it's the Gator Cops, and he's saying, "I give up." You know, he throws his hand up. The Gator Cops show up. He's like, "I give up, I give up," and then paddles away with his feet faster
like
than you would believe possible.
Moment.
No, that's the other funny thing is the speed of his feet is like cartoon-esque, like as if like it was just going to go so fast that a cloud of dust would appear and then his boat would just be out of frame.
It's almost like there was no need for the boat. He would just paddle Scooby-Doo style super fast on the surface of the water and then take
off. Yeah, no. The front of the boat would snap off and it would just be him running on the water. Although, nature. By the way, like, there not a peep from the daughter on the back of the boat.
Yeah. Oh, is that a daughter in the back of the boat?
Yes. That's the little arm you see wave out over the water right before the gator pops up into the surface.
Holy cow! And you have to imagine, like, we see the teeth and the snout breach. But you have to believe he was able to see through the water, like right down to that dude's eyes.
Brian, and I think this is why Amazon Prime may be the most important survival invention in mankind.
Yeah, this is why I want humans taken out of the equation as soon as possible, because then at least after the apocalypse, Amazon Prime will still work.
We need Apocalypse Prime.
Wait, well, like, hold on. I just, that's a crazy thought. Think about it. If we hit a certain level of automation and then a giant meteor strikes and it wipes out a third of humanity, survival will mean figuring out clever ways to hack Amazon to be convinced that you still have money and are a good credit risk so that the robots will still deliver goods. Because, like, the robots couldn't make a policy decision of, like, oh, we're in an apocalypse. Instead, they're only going to care, does he have good credit? Yeah, we'll deliver it by drone. In other words, just like in apocalypse, you might stumble across a piece of technology, let's say a hand crank, water pump or something. Water pump doesn't care that there's a nuke went off or that a meteor crashed into Earth. Water pump just knows that somebody's cranking the handle and out comes water. I think at some level of automation, that's what Amazon would be like, right?
I think that would be the dream. I mean, that's what we were talking about a little bit in the last podcast about the idea of the future of space travel, how it integrates with a fully artificially intelligent automated travel system. The idea that when everything is just fully integrated in that way, that we don't even think about that. And we're starting to see Amazon has warehouses with people and robots, and the people have to get out of the way of the robots. And where that moves to, you know, where does that go towards? And like, yeah, I think that's the interesting idea that a system that could survive even such a calamity there and designed for that. Like the internet was designed to survive, you know, nuclear war.
Yeah.
I'm sending you one of the first items we could probably have is for food
supplies. In our new service, Apocalypse Prime.
Yeah. Bryce, so Apocalypse Prime, I think we need to start that, but it's going to be a little more pricier than regular Amazon Prime because you have to deal with mutant cockroaches and stuff.
6 gallons of this. What? It weighs almost 50 pounds.
That's Jim Baker.
I know
him.
You don't want to hear this.
Wait,
but I want
that
to
same
you,
Jim Baker, the one that was married to Tammy Faye?
Yep.
Jim Baker on TV telling you, get ready. And you say, oh my God, why didn't I order something? I want to eat some more of this.
This is amazing. For those people not watching the video, we're seeing an infomercial style overlay on there. A bunch of people standing around watching a full-grown man eat soup from a bucket, talking about how it's only $160 plus shipping for a donation of $160 or more. You could get a bulk bucket of creamy potato soup.
Soup.
And for some reason, Nancy Grace is there.
Yeah. So 7 years of food that you can get out of that creamy potato soup bucket. But this is, I guess, all for doomsday preppers.
Yeah, you still need clean water, though, right?
You got a morning cake.
For all of this, I assume it's dehydrated.
Put that chocolate on top. You can have parties.
Yeah.
The world's coming apart.
Either way, I just heard like just the stray wild line of Jim Baker saying you can have a party, like that. This is like, hey, listen, even in the apocalypse, you got to look out for your social life. You know, these neighbors are still going to talk whether or not the rest of the planet is dead.
So what's the appropriate amount of? So we live in a just-in-time economy, kind of similar to, you know, we've become this singular body where dollars and goods and services flow all over the United States, all over the world, much the way oxygenated blood flows through a human body. And there's certain lengths of time different organs can last without oxygenated blood before they start to die. I think the doomsday preppers have a reputation for being kooky because they want to believe in such thing as complete self-sufficiency. But the only, you know, as one of the things you learn when you read like The Rational Optimist is the only true self-sufficiency is abject Stone Age poverty, right? Everything else, if you want to actually have any decent standard of living, you're going to actually want to have to trade with other people. But the question is, like, where's the line where you go over the edge? Like, what's the difference between drinking soup from a plastic bucket?
Barely keeping it together as Jim Baker samples and is so impressed with his creamy potato soup out of a comically large ladle.
What's funny is that it's not even like he doesn't have it on a shelf in front of him. He's hunched over like a hobo riding the silver rails, just scooping from a ladle, drinking his creamy potato soup.
Out of a mop bucket, you know. This is survival. I don't want to survive.
Just so pleased with it.
So, and Brian, answer your question. I think that, you know, there certainly is, it depends. I mean, obviously in full out, you know, asteroid impact, dinosaur killer, that's one thing. But, you know, Justin and I grew up in South Florida. And, you know, if you're sensible, you had enough supplies to last for a week or so. You know, you kept water, you kept these other things because a hurricane would come through. It would take out power. You wouldn't have safe water for a while. Where my parents live, my parents have a generator. You know, we have friends who have generators and are able to keep food cold for a while. We've had, when Hurricane Andrew hit, you know, our neighborhood was without power, without anything for like over a week. And there were some neighborhoods were as far as a month. And it wasn't just power, but it was like your access, as you point out. Like, you know, if supermarkets don't have refrigeration, they're not refrigerating things. And if it's hard to get trucks through because of down power lines and stuff, you know, there's a certain amount of responsibility. Where I live in LA, you know, if we get a big earthquake, I'm going to die, you know. I accept that.
You know, this is one of the this is an idea that's explored in the, I would say, slightly hysterical, and I don't mean that in a funny sense, but I mean in a compensatory way. But the novel One Second After deals with the idea of a giant electromagnetic pulse taking out, you know, all electronic devices. And in the early days of the disaster, it's like, well, none of our refrigerators work when there's no power, so let's just cook up and we'll have like a cookout. And then they have kind of like almost a festival party atmosphere. And then flash forward to a year and a half afterwards where there's tribal warfare. And then people are like, yeah, my pregnant daughter needs food, so we're going to slaughter our dog now. And it's I guess it's really a question of how long do you want to be covered and at what level of comfort. Because I don't know. It seems to me like a week of food or a year of food, if it's that level of disaster, it doesn't seem like it's going to make a big difference one way or the other.
Oh, I think that there's how quickly you can rebuild some sort of infrastructure or survival. How quickly can you get something going? And so a week means great. Your week is you're waiting for the government to come in and fix things. A year means you're going to have to figure out things locally. And I think there are a lot of people in Utah that are going to look pretty smug.
No. I mean, listen, the rest of us are going to be stabbing each other with sharp sticks, and you know, someone's going to make their way to Salt Lake, and it'll look like the city from Guardians of the Galaxy. It'll be nicer for they'll have invented things from when the apocalypse happened.
Yeah. So it's one of these things too. There is a interesting cultural difference too that. The further north a culture lives, you know, then has to deal with the longer the winters they have to deal with, you find there's an interesting correlation between their economic success. So, you know, your Scandinavian countries, which are quite prosperous, yet they're freezing, you know, and it's because they plan. That, you know, they plan for these things.
That's certainly, and we've seen that not only with meteorological isolation, but even in, you know, like take a look at Hong Kong. Hong Kong essentially had no resources. It had a port and rocks everywhere, and it had a democratic government under British rule, where pretty much everybody just promised two things. They say we're going to drink tea and we're going to enforce contracts, and that's it. And in doing so, they maximized that benefit, and they were able to become extremely prosperous.
A lot of trading ports do that, but you know, on a larger scale, some of the places you wouldn't expect to. So.
I was going to say, I never thought about that. But, like, you know, if you compare and contrast the economic success that some of the Scandinavian countries have had compared to, you know, like Greece. Like, you know, that equator, man, that could be a real real son of a bitch.
Yeah.
I wonder why that is. I wonder what it is about having what they call it. I guess economists call it the curse of abundance or the curse of resources.
If you have to deal with long winters, you're going to be either culturally or maybe perhaps genetically wired towards, guys, we need to save a lot of that. We need to save seed for when we have to plant it. We need to save food to last us through theirs. And you start investing mental energies and capabilities to figuring out how to preserve. And then you start developing things like banking and the idea of, I will put aside some resources now instead of consuming everything I have, because I know that 6 months from now, 7 months from now, I'm going to need it. And if winter lasts longer or whatever, and that uncertainty culturally causes this sense of,
You know, it's almost as though the most civilized, forward-thinking economies are countries located in places where they're awfully aware that at all times, winter is coming.
Well, that's the kind of messaging you can remember and cuts through all the clutter to remind people of things. Kind of like how patreon.com/weirdthings immediately reminds everybody listening to us that they can support this show by heading over to that URL and donating whatever they would like to give to us. See, you know, this is a model in which we appreciate your support, and we are very, very, very happy to have your financial backing. So if you'd like to support us, head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings.
I want to thank all of our supporters, all of our fans, all of our listeners, by telling them that I'm disappointed in you people.
What do they do this time?
My Lord. What? I mean, with the language.
All right. I'm making an indignant face. All right. I'm trying to sigh as much as I can. Well, you know, every time I start to go do the show, I do a little search for things like goblins and other stuff. I do a little search for ways in which Brian can have his family tortured. And, you know, I do want to see, like, let's get some good ghost photos, right? And so, the big story of this last couple weeks is the Stanley Hotel, which, you know, is what, like, the model in The Shining. Like, ooh, look at these spooky ghost photos. And
are they good? Are they scary? Are they spooky?
Look at Stanley Hotel ghost photo. You tell me. You tell me.
All right, hold on.
Does your skin crawl? Do you feel the hair on the back of your neck raised?
Sam, I'm certainly, when you sell it that way, it's pretty good.
Yeah, well, let's see. There's one of a guy who's in front of a – do a news search, actually. Do the news there you go. A first one there, right there. All right, prepare yourself, guys. I'm not responsible for what
It's a good-looking young man standing in front of the Stanley Hotel.
He's really handsome.
Yeah, neither of them will say he's an Asian dude because it doesn't matter. But that's
I think he's very handsome.
Wait, hold on. There's a circle drawn around.
Don't zoom in, please.
Hold on. It looks like keep going. I still don't see.
Guys.
I mean, it looks like what appears to be an extended wing.
I'm sorry, guys. I've got to pour a salt circle around myself right now.
Okay. I am looking at nothing but just a mush of pixels. I don't see how this could possibly be anything.
No, Brian. It's obviously a...
No. Tell me. What is it? What is it, obviously, before we read the rest?
A gigantic turkey baster that has leaned up against the window. Nozzle first.
Okay,
but here's the evidence. It wasn't in this other photo that was taken 2 minutes later.
Hold on.
Open. Boom, boom, in your face.
Timeout. Also, the sun is pointing the opposite direction in the other photo. That's 2 minutes, you say?
Well, that's what this thedenverchannel.com article supposes, and then they also make that same examination.
Oh my God, this is maybe the best thing ever.
But after closer examination, one can see the direction of the shadows cast by the sun differ from one photo to the other.
I would say fairly dramatically. We're looking at the difference between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. in the shadows, going opposite directions.
So, all right, if we're going to play into it, then obviously this is just a playful ghost that likes to make itself known in very esoteric and weird ways. If we want to be real about it, there was like, when I used to work at newspapers, at the end of the day, you had to work on something and you had to turn something in because there was a news hole for which you had to fill. And this to me has like, hey, listen, you got to get something in. And it's like, well, all I got is this stupid Stanley Hotel ghost thing. Yeah, fine. Just put a circle on it. Whatever.
Are you gonna? It's like
it's a hand drawn circle.
Yeah. You want to do some? You want to do some original reporting? Why don't you point out the fact that the shadows go two clearly different directions?
Well, guys, I want you to know there's some other photos. If you do a USA Today, your ghost stories from the Shining Hotel in Colorado. USA Today is on the beat, guys, collecting these stories.
Let's see. It says here.
Call them the McDonald's of news, will you?
Your ghost stories from the Shining Hotel. Now, by the way, there's a lot of hotels that allegedly are the Shining Hotel. I assume this is the one that the movie was shot at, or that one was in Oregon, wasn't it?
No, I think this one, the Stanley Hotel does have a history, both with The Shining and beyond it. I know they do a film festival every year that like centers on horror.
Yeah, the exteriors were the one in Oregon.
Yeah. But I know that the book was based on another one in, I want to say New Hampshire. I did a gig there once. I should see if I should.
Guys, you just passed right by the ghost. Why? And you're.
Wait, hold on. Wait, I didn't see any ghosts.
You can pretend you're not afraid if you want. That's fine.
These ghosts.
We just had a photo, and we did a Ken Burns. No, back. The thing Bryce was playing the video of, and it's gone now.
Oh, these guys?
It's on the top. Hold on.
Here. Yeah, here we go. This is USA Today Network. Can we hear a little bit of the audio here?
I showed you a picture from the Stanley Hotel that appears to show something, and he say a ghost, at the top of the staircase of the hotel.
A lot of people debating on social media about images, of the image's authenticity, so we got a professional opinion. We sent the picture to Kevin Sampron, the president and founder of Spirit Paranormal Investigations. He says that in over 90% of cases his team looks into, natural causes are what to blame for what people think is paranormal activity. However, he says this picture's legit. The team found no evidence of tampering or photoshopped. In fact, they found what they believe is a second ghost.
They found a second ghost!
When we blew up the picture of the anomaly, I immediately saw a second anomaly just to the left of the first figure. And so it looks like the first anomaly appears to us to be like a lady dressed in black. And to the left of her, it looks like what is a child. You can see the child's head clearly outlined over the top of the stale railing, just to the left of the woman in it.
Man.
Kevin says he and his team believe it could be a ghost of a mother and her child.
Do you know what the internet has done to ruin everything? It's what? Like the lights are always on now. Like there was a good time when I was a teenager when I could really scare the pants off myself at 2 a.m. I'd tuck my head under my covers because I didn't want to come out because everything, even though I didn't believe in ghosts, they still scared the pants off me. But then the lights would turn on and you're watching infomercials at 3 a.m. and suddenly ghosts don't seem as scary. It's like the internet has brought that state of being to a permanent place at this point.
Oh no, Brian, you're not going to the right websites.
Oh yeah?
I mean,
yeah, well, all right. Humanity. So where do we start here? Do we start with just like these kinds of photos in general? Do we start about, you know, the fact that this is a story that takes up X amount of time on a local news station and the only people that they send the picture to are the spirit informational squad for whom they're like, I swear to God, man, I swear, baby, I never talk to these girls, but you, you're special. In fact, I see a second ghost.
I mean, there's part of me that's jealous of him that he's able to scare. I mean, one of the most fun times I've ever had in my entire life was staying overnight at Wolf Manor. One of the first times I hung out with Brett Rounceville, and it was me and CJ Johnson and Captain MG. It was amazing, scaring the crap out of ourselves. I can understand the appeal of that lifestyle.
Do you think that is the interaction for him, or is it for him, like, proving that he's right? Yeah, and looking at a bunch of random noise and finding, you know, the pattern that he has sworn to everybody else is truly there.
Well, here's what I suspect. You hear a lot of people, whenever they talk about the paranormal, whenever they hit upon that brick wall that separates the, yeah, but there's no evidence for it. And then they respond, yeah, but I have this feeling, or I know the feeling I have is real. That feeling they have is the beginnings of an argument that they've made in their own mind and that they have scared themselves or spooked themselves or gotten themselves into a state of mind where they're like, hey, yeah, dude, I feel it. I feel it really, really strongly. And then they try to go to the second level of like, can you take that feeling and expand it to another person? Can you give someone else that feeling by telling the right story and making the right case? Because like, for example, here, let's throw that image back up there. I mean, if you look at it just right, if I tell you that there's a gorgeous young woman in a black dress looking leftward over her shoulder, the more of this I do, the more of it you can kind of see her and draw it. And it's as though you're creating something in there. And I think that there's an electricity of that moment when you see it, either for yourself or when you get someone else to see it, that I think is highly addictive. I think that's a big part of why somebody goes into this full time.
But I mean, that's the same part of the brain that likes magic eyes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like that. It's random noise until it appears to you.
Yeah, totally. Agreed. And magic tricks while we're at it, you know, it's like, what is a magic routine, but like seven unrelated odd movements for people to do, that all come together in the last part when they add up to something like, wait, I saw the seven pieces that went into this and there should be a bloody body cut in half right now. And there's not. And it's that novelty that gives you that aha serotonin rush.
And I think that's really what when you were laying out, and for those of you, all right, describe the EVP for people who might not have seen you live.
Oh, you're talking about the stage routine?
Yeah, yeah.
Man, EVP is easily my favorite thing I ever wrote. It starts off with an explanation, kind of an overview of what the idea of electronic voice phenomenon is, the idea of ghosts getting caught on tape. I would play some clips of what were allegedly ghosts being caught on audio tape that, you know, maybe it's just random noise or artifacts. Then you look at static and you can see faces in there and so on. And then I would tell a particular story, and at this point is very much just a made up ghost story about a couple that lived in a house built by a man in the late 1800s, died around the mid 60s, and they had one experience where they were watching TV, and all of a sudden the signal went crazy, but they happened to snap a photo during the middle of that, and when they got back the developed photo, they said they could see a face in there. So. I play the tape, and the first time you watch it, you see nothing extraordinary. The second time I say, watch it again. This time, watch it through your cell phone camera. If you see something weird, try to get a picture of it. And the second time, it's the most amazing response I ever got on my stage show's history, because, you know, people would start screaming and shouting and pushing on each other because half the people didn't see anything, but the other half on their phone, plain as day, see this really creepy, haunting ghost face show up.
As somebody who's watched that routine a bunch of times, there is a reliable element of there might be a riot that breaks out from this. Like, there is an almost like weird, dangerous, unstable, jagged edge for that energy, which is so rare with a magic trick, because like looking at these photos, it is personal. I've discovered something. The person that is holding up the phone has discovered something or seen something. And that just makes this weird rumbling where
it's flirting. It's flirting on the edges of a manufactured hysteria, right? It's a bit of that mosh pit feeling of that vibe. I mean, part of it is that I insist on everybody packing together as close as they can. Part of that is for the practicality of if the ghost doesn't show up on one phone, it'll at least show up on the phone next to him. The other part of that is when somebody next to you is panicked on your right and somebody on the left is panicked, panic is infectious, right? And you want a little bit of that panic to start to arise.
Well, speaking of infectious panic, I have a little more background on the Stanley Hotel.
Okay.
Go.
That is where Stephen King stayed and got the idea for The Shining, or The Shining, as we say. He says from his website,
Superboy.
In the late September of 1974, Tabby and I spent a night at the Grand Hotel in Estes Park, the Stanley. We were the only guests, as it turned out. The following day, they were going to close the place down for winter. Wandering through its corridors, I thought it seemed the perfect, maybe the archetypical setting for a ghost story. That night, I dreamed of my three-year-old son running through the corridors, looking back over his shoulder, eyes wide, screaming. He was being chased by a fire hose. I woke up with a tremendous jerk, sweating all over with an inch of falling out of bed. I got up, lit a cigarette, sat in a chair looking out the window at the Rockies, and by the time the cigarette was done, I had the bones of the book firmly set in my mind.
The book was
was Stand By Me.
That whole period, I believe that's around the time he wrote, I guess that was the beginning of it. He refers to this decade-long period where in his life, this is also when he was high a lot, when he was drunk a lot, he couldn't think of anything more terrifying than just something bad happening to his children. So as a result, that's when he put in Cujo, where the book ends with the kid dying, and he put Pet Cemetery involves a toddler getting run over by a giant truck and all that stuff. It's just like basically the most horrible stuff happening to his own children all made it into that decade of books.
I found the original Instagram photo for the lobby photo for it's Ares, A-R-E-S 415, and you can find the photo there, and it's not much more clear.
A-R-E-S, yeah. I mean, that just looks like a woman at the top of the stairs, right?
Woman in a Doctor Who TARDIS costume.
Yeah, and all she has to do, all you have to do to make this a terrifying thing is say, but there was no woman there.
Yes.
So, serious ghost hunters on the planet, right? With where technology has gone and our understanding that even digital photographs can often create very weird, unexplained artifacts, like what would be our burden of proof to see, to catch a ghost?
Well, here's the unfortunate thing is that the most credible ghost photos are the least inspiring because a good ghost photo has a great story that builds up a lot of credibility, has a narrative that sets up the idea that you might see something and has that payoff of like, and this is the photo I captured at the end. And then you get chills because you have the context and the backstory for it.
So you have to know who died, right? It's not just like, oh, I found this photo and then it's just, you know, like Dave Foley and Brain Candy. Like, who, me? I'm just a guy. Oh, I died a while ago and I'm just a ghost. No real story for me.
I think that's part of what makes it so infectious as a, essentially like a viral ghost story at that point.
It's interesting how many of these photos you find out. They're, like I said, the good ones usually be they didn't, there was nothing at the time. And then afterwards, they look through there and they see something weird. And they go look up the history of the place. Like, oh, so back to my earlier point and my disappointment with everybody. I want you guys out there to send us your best ghost photos.
Yeah, and make sure to include good stories with it. I don't want to see no orbs. That's why I hate orbs. Orbs are like, here's a dot. It's like, yeah, look, there's plenty of pictures that have dots.
You have an orb if you swear there was no other light source in the room.
Or at least have a good story about how will-o-wisps used to be famous in that area or something, and then you caught one or something.
Or at least say it was ghost writer, not ghost rider.
Ghost writer? he's got the flaming skull head. He's just like, oh, my publisher will love this.
Oh, click, click. You ever saw Ghost Rider?
No.
Ghost Rider was a children's show where a little glowing orb would fly in and write things. And
oh, that's amazing. That's awesome.
All right, gentlemen, do we have time for one more topic or do you want to jump into picks?
Let's do another topic.
Yeah.
You know, we touched on this last time and I want to ask you your thoughts on this. We mentioned Project Starshot, which was this ambitious idea. Yuri Milner's funding this project to build this massive, to start, you know, the development of a massive laser array that can then project phased array beams onto a meter-wide reflector and send a payload to the nearest star system, Alpha Centauri, within 15 to 20 years, right?
Right.
Crazy idea of interstellar probes is awesome. It's interesting. This week, there was another one of those articles. You're like, man, this would be really cool if this was true. It's the EM drive. The EM drive is this theoretical propulsion system where it uses this sort of conical-shaped cavity, and there's like a microwave emitter at one end, and it's supposed to move forward without emitting any mass, which...
That just can't be, right? That violates the laws of conservation of mass and energy, right?
Effectively. I mean, you can shoot a laser beam out the back and you're going to have, you know, some sort of propulsion, but this isn't like that. This is actually supposed to be far more powerful than photonic propulsion by the amount of energy you're putting into it. It's not emitting anything, but somehow it's moving forwards or whatever. And that's the problem, is that it violates, you know, what we know about physics. And so it's been rejected out of hand by many people who are like, hey, no. But a number of laboratories around the world have done some investigations into it, and they have reported non-zero measurements, and including NASA's Eagle Works has been doing research into this. Other places have been doing this, and it could be experimental error. You know, there's so, you know, it's more likely to be experimental error. And there is some report that we may be getting a write-up coming out soon from a laboratory that's reported that they have actually had positive experience. They have positive results on this. There is a theory floating out there by a physicist who says that he thinks that it can be explained by something about like Kaur theory, which has to deal with how inertia works, and that it doesn't really violate the law. You know, the idea that the way inertia is created, this is actually something that capitalizes on that. These are things that are beyond me. And UNRU radiation is one of the explanations that somebody's thrown out there. And you can listen, I've poured through, you know, the pros and the cons and all these sorts of things, and a lot of really, really gifted PhD, high-level people are having a back and forth about this, and all I can say is, man, this is interesting, you know? I like Skittles. So if this – but this is still – it's a very interesting area of research, and there's other things that are more conventional. There's plasma rockets we talked about before. There's a company called Positron Dynamics, which is trying to develop antimatter technologies. My question is this. All of this comes to this. Should we be spending like way we're right now, we have a program called the SLS. The SLS, which is this big, huge rocket system, which is based on old kind of shuttle and Saturn V technology, which is our plan to go back into space, but we don't really have a plan to actually go back into space other than to see if this rocket works. Should we be doing more ambitious, you know, spending billions of dollars on developing all these crazy kinds of technologies?
And by we mean NASA. We mean the federal government. Yeah.
I mean, if NASA has any mandate in space, I would say its responsibility is to further and hasten our reaching out to the stars by doing the things that commercial enterprises won't. Commercial enterprises, for all the eye rolling that we give Neil deGrasse Tyson for being so anti, pro government, anti commercial space exploration, he is right in that commercial governments pioneered a lot of that early exploration, and now we're at a point where private industry is benefiting from it. So that's great. So what is private industry not doing yet because it's not cost effective? They are not building permanent structures on celestial bodies. And it seems to me that's what NASA's number one benefit could be, contribution to humanity, is to hollow out an asteroid, to build a lunar base, to get us out there, and to, you know, go ahead and use private industry as the ferries that get us out of the gravity well. But mainly it's insane to us that we would crawl out of a gravity well to grab resources just to pull them back down into the gravity well with us. It seems like we should be building facilities out there that use the resources out there. That's what it seems like to me.
Well, my question that gets back into is that there are a lot of these riskier sorts of things, these more exotic forms of propulsion and stuff. And I'm not saying EM drive, but other things, plasma, stuff like that. And NASA does, to their credit, provide some seed funding, developmental funding for this. But there aren't much bigger initiatives, and there might be a reason why that would be a bad idea too. But I would say something like Project Starshot, which uses existing technologies, which is an engineering thing. It seems to me that's the kind of thing that we should be looking into instead of, you know, for the price of what we're going to be spending on the SLS, we could have an infrastructure capable of sending probes to other star systems and putting things all around our solar system very, very quickly.
So I'm just a simple country bumpkin that doesn't know much about federal governmental budgets, but the SLS seems like something that in an era where NASA did not have anything on the books for space travel or had to pay Russia to get up into space seemed like something that was big and meaty and aggressive enough that it could continue to justify its budgetary thirst in a world pre, you know, SpaceX, you know, proving that a lot of what they are doing is indeed real, and the idea of a far cheaper way of getting into space from an American private industry was more of a realistic solution. So if we are then to say, like, okay, well, let's say over the next 3 years we see NASA maybe cool on what they'll do with SLS, or maybe the vision is scaled back, and therefore you need, you know, NASA's not just going to give back earmarked money. Like, you got to think, okay, well, what else are we going to do with it? What else are we going to ask for that continues to keep the line up on the budget that they do have, which I'm sure everybody, you know, there is a large portion of this crap.
I mean, they can't. Congress has said you have to build this thing because the Congress critters who voted for this thing are the ones that have, they're going to be getting the bulk of the budget spent in their states.
Yeah.
Like
my county is the one that makes the sprockets that allow the gyroscope to spin the shuttle leftward.
Sure. So then forget that scenario. And I think what I was trying to get to was the idea that would it be better if I do agree with you, Andrew. I mean, I think that they're trying to figure out new propulsion methods. There's you know, little downside. And if we look at the argument of like, hey, look, let's just put time, effort, research, and a budget toward solving problems that may or may not be solved because they're not cost effective enough that a private industry is going to dive in and try to find that monkey, then I'm down for that.
Well, I guess that's the thing that's for me is I find frustrating is that there's so much awesome stuff that NASA is doing in so many different areas. And then, you know, there's a certain amount of excitement over SLS because its payload capabilities will increase a lot of things. But then you look at it and you go, okay, here it is. We're 2016 and we are building the most expensive disposable rocket ever. And that is the biggest part of NASA's budget. That's the biggest part of NASA's mandate is to ignore, you know, all these radical developments that have happened in the last 40, 50 years and to say, no, we're going to build the biggest pork project ever.
Well, and a lot of that is, you know, the people behind the SLS are you know, the usual suspects for people that, you know, build these kind of government contracted items, right? Like, this is just an extension of that relationship.
I guess that's the thing where when there's a dialogue about, hey, NASA needs more money, I get frustrated because I'm like, I'm for that, but let's talk about how it's being spent. So I was at the California Science Center, and they're upstairs, and they have this little exhibit where you can put, like, this is put a token there for this little slot for how much money you think NASA should get, and then we're going to show you how much they get, you know, and people are like, oh, it's a shame. I'm like, well, we spend five times on all of Europe, you know. So we there's got to be a metric there. My frustration is, like, does it matter to you how it's spent? Are you asking questions about how it's spent? If you're not, it doesn't matter how much money you put into it.
Yeah. No, that's fair enough. Hey, so I'm running up against a deadline. Can we move into picks? I have an unconventional one this week.
Guys, why don't we move into picks in case somebody has a deadline?
So I got an email. I just forwarded it to both of you guys and to Bryce, who has amazingly already put together a link for it. But longtime listener to the show and I believe patron, Paul Freeland, writes me the following letter that I thought was really interesting. He says, hi, Brian. Got a little behind on Weird Things, finals week, moving house, etc., and just caught up today. I heard you and Andrew starting to discuss the issue of a constraint-free economy and universal basic income, something I've been looking into. I admit that some of my interest may be motivated by being a college student who's juggling four jobs just to pay the rent, though it's a fascinating idea all by itself. Apologies for sending this so close to the next episode, but here are some of the links I've bookmarked if you'd like some more material on the subject. Some of them deal with tangential but possibly related subjects such as the minimum wage and other things that would need reconsidering if UBI is brought into play. I think that I have an idea which way the discussion on the podcast will go, but you never know. And he just gives me this motherload of Slate articles, freethoughtblogs.com article, independent articles, The Nation articles, New York Times articles. So just now, I have not read all this, but this is an amazing question. And it's a big question I'm sure we're going to talk about for a long time. What happens when humanity wins so hard that it theoretically breaks the rules of capitalism, or at least some people would suggest that? And you know, I don't want to drag us into it right now, but I do think it would be a fun reading project for us to read all these.
I would love to know which are the ones are pro and which are the ones con, so we can go back and forth.
Yeah, sure. Well, and Bryce put it together. If you go to bit.ly/constraint-free, that'll take you that'll link you to the list of all of his links. That might be a fun kind of group reading project that we can maybe argue about next week on it.
Yeah. Again, my knee-jerk reaction is, I started from the point of view of reading all things like why this is a great idea, da 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 da, and then I said, let me read into some of the anti-arguments for this just so I can see, and then I'm like, oh my God, there is a lot of scary things. So that's kind of my question is that I'm hesitant to put this out there until we know that, hey, here's the pro and here's the con, because I don't want to be pushing all of the, yeah, this is all why it's a good idea.
Oh, no. I don't know, we'll see. Let us discuss.
I know, but I'm saying we should also be accumulating just so we know, you know, not because it's very easy. Like I, in the constraint free stuff, when I watch the TED Talks, all this, I'm like, yeah, this sounds inevitable. This sounds very, and I got into that echo chamber. I'm like, yeah, no. And this makes sense because robots have this, da, da, da. And then I started listening. I'm like, but let me be a good critical thinker and let me go outside and go listen to the, hey, no, this is why it's a horrible idea.
Well, okay, hold on.
So,
I guess.
So let's just all understand that this is Paul Freeland. He has curated these. We do not know Paul's point of view or his sorting method, but if it is tilted one way or another, blame Paul.
I say let's read everything. Read all the things. Let's not wait for any reason. Let's put it all out.
Well, I'm saying yes and try to seek dissenting opinion on this because I'm already looking through this. And they are, I would say, when I read the phrase libertarian lunatics in one of the essays.
To be honest, I'm attracted to that. That immediately makes me want to look and read more.
I would say that yes, Brian, but I would also love to hear the libertarian lunatic point of view too.
Sure. I'm here anytime you need me.
Yes. You're an anarchist, Brian.
It's fine.
Gentlemen, that is Brian's pick. By all means, course through there. Let's have a discussion about this. Be good. And like I said, whenever something really appeals to you, go listen to the dissenting opinion because there's emotional arguments are the most persuasive and they're also the least based in fact.
And by the way, the part of the reason I'm attracted to all this is because I don't believe there is I don't want to get it political. Doesn't matter. I almost certainly disagree with all these, which is why I'm excited about reading them.
My pick's Beyonce.
What happened last night? I got this alert from HBO saying Beyonce's important. And then all of a sudden all of Twitter was like, thank God for Beyonce. And I'm like, what is happening?
Oh, you missed it, Brian.
Beyonce debuted her album. She's got a new album coming out. And like what she did on her last album, she only had very, very minimal pre-press for it and kind of dropped it out of nowhere last time. This time, there was a little bit of pre-press that she was going to do a one-day-only show of some sort on HBO on Saturday night. What you found out as you watched it was that it was basically her entire album interspliced with like poetry and it was shot very, very well. It's a lot of really good music videos put together into one seamless thing. And then she dropped her album while it was airing on the East Coast. So I'm not a huge Beyonce fan. Like, I don't know if I've ever listened to a Beyonce album all the way through, but everybody was yelling and screaming about it, and I watched it, and I thought it was really good. So, considering I think that it's going to be off HBO, at least I don't know whatever fake window they've created for how long that thing's going to be there. I'm sure it'll be on the internet forever. But it was interesting. It was cool, and I always like people trying to do, especially big artists, you know, trying to release things in new and different ways because I think it's very interesting when people are trying to like inch around the way of like, okay, what's a great new model for distribution in 2016? And I feel like people are getting closer and closer to it and no one's really hit it, but you're getting some really interesting experimentation that I think we'll miss when things kind of harden up over the next 5-10 years and there's just a very clear way to release an album.
Right on.
Gentlemen, imagine a plot like this. Three men, mysterious men, arrive in Moscow on a Learjet and try to buy an ICBM missile. A man dressed in a leather trench coat shows up in the garage. of a rocket designer asking him suspicious questions about the technology.
Is this the plot to the Chevy Chase Dan Aykroyd movie Spies Like Us?
No.
Okay.
A man in Utah who had previously arrested by the Russians for trying to sell international secrets gets approached by a man claiming to be a billionaire, asking for his help in securing a weapon. What? Sound familiar?
No. What is this?
This is the Elon Musk biography.
Oh!
So Ashley Vance, who's a pretty well-known writer, is wrote a biography of Elon Musk. And I hesitated for a while because when it came out, there was a bit of the back and forth where Musk was frustrated by some of the portrayals, and they're predictably so. And actually at one point, but it starts off where Vance says Musk had asked to be able to do like a footnote rebuttal to everything in there. And Vance is like, no, I have my journalistic integrity. Although part of me is like, well, that would be a better book though, wouldn't it though? You know, you write your thing and let Musk have his response to it. So I'm partway into this, and it is an extremely – a lot of times I'm hesitant, like how Star Wars conquered the universe. I'm like, I know the Star Wars story. And then, nope, way more than I realized. This is a fascinating book that goes into Musk's childhood. It talks to people very close to him. There is a point of view. Vance has a point of view on this, but I would say that he is unlike the Steve Jobs bio where you realize the guy writing it, had no grasp of Jobs and really what he did. This is, I thought, is so far very, very good, very, very detailed, and I know anecdotal stories about Musk from friends, and a lot of it matches up to what I've heard, but it's fascinating. It's an absolutely fascinating story, and, the fact that when he was first trying, he wanted to, put a greenhouse on Mars and wanted to do these things, and he's trying to buy rockets and try to get involved in this stuff, and the story of those early days of SpaceX, how it wasn't a given, and he's like, oh, now I'll build a rocket company. It was dealing with all these frustrating things, trying to buy rockets and realizing how problematic the industry is. There's amusing stories like when he, when he sold like his company Zip2, he went out and bought himself a McLaren F1, which is the fastest production car there is. And he would drive it every day, like just drive it around for like a regular car, which other McLaren, car owners are just aghast at. And
sure,
he sent an email to Larry Ellison because he heard Ellison had one and said, hey, do you want to go take him to the track and race them? And which prompted Jim Clark, one of the prolific investors, to, go race down to the Ferrari dealership to buy something that he could compete with. And Musk takes somebody for a drive. They're on their way to a meeting at Sand Hill, which is the big VC avenue. And they're in the car. And Musk says, watch this. Swerves the car, skids around, catches air, hits an embankment, and all the windows shatter.
Whoa!
And Musk turns to him and says, the funny thing is, it's not insured.
Dude, that's a guy that's having too much fun with life. That's awesome.
Yeah, and it's funny, too, because they talk about, that Vance will say, in those early days, he would say the typically rich guy douchey things in interviews and stuff, and you get insight into his childhood in South Africa. He was bullied tremendously, one point hospitalized after some kids shoved him downstairs. Very, very traumatic childhood. And he was desperate to come to America. That was his plan. And when he found out that because of his mother's Canadian ancestry, he could get Canadian citizenship, 17 years old, gets a plane ticket, flies to Canada, shows up trying to find, because he figures Canada's close to the United States, tries to find a relative, then finds out that they'd moved to Minnesota. So he's basically bumming, places to, hitchhiking, bumming places to stay. I don't know if he's hitchhiking. I maybe threw that in there. Places to stay from relatives and all that. Spends a year in Canada working odd jobs, like stoking coal furnaces and chopping wood and doing just about all the most menial, hardworking stuff you can imagine because he's desperate to sort of make a new life.
That is amazing. I was about to ask if there's an audio version, and I see there's audible narration right there. Yeah, excellent.
That's what I'm listening to right now.
Good deal.
Dude, so, great pick.
That's my temporary pick right now until Vance disappoints me. But no, I think it's so far, I felt like Vance seems like, reading into it kind of like, well, is seems to be trying to be objective about their subject. But it doesn't feel like a hit piece at all, although Musk probably feels differently. And we'll see where it goes on to it later on.
Interesting. So.
And that's my pick.
Sweet.
It's been weird.
Penguin Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.